Get yourself on over to Judges chapter 19. I already shared with you at chapter 17 that these final chapters, chapter 17 through 21, are out of chronological order. And I shared with you that these stories actually happened pretty early on during the time period of the Judges. The first proof that I gave to you for that was Jonathan the Levite. He was the grandson of Moses, and we'll get another proof tonight in our study in Judges chapter 20, verse 28, as we read about Phinehas, who was the grandson of Aaron. So that is a second time stamp in these last four chapters for us that lets us know that for sure these final four chapters of the book, they're taking place just two generations removed from Moses and Aaron. So the things that we're studying, these things happened during the lifetimes of the grandchildren of Moses and Aaron. And you know by now what is happening in these four chapters. Chapters 17 through 21 are given to make a major statement and then give us stories or history that then proves that statement to be true. And that statement is that in those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. And then when we consider the Lord's assessment of this time period of Judges, he didn't say it like that, did he? He didn't say, well, everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. He said it like this. Everyone was doing what was wicked or evil in the sight of the Lord. So a very different assessment. Man looks at it and says, well, I'm just doing what seems right to me. And the Lord would say, well, yeah, apart from me, apart from my word, what you're actually doing is resorting naturally to ungodliness. So that's the overarching theme of these final four chapters. These are supposed to be God's people here. They are supposed to know the Lord. They're supposed to be walking with the Lord. They don't know the Lord. They're not following the Lord's laws. They're not obeying the Lord. They have no regard for the Lord. They're not really the Lord's people. They do what they think is right, and that results in sin and even wickedness against the Almighty. And since we know that lesson very well for, let's face it, the majority of this book, and certainly for the final four chapters of the book, we're going to be able to move through these final three chapters pretty quickly. And I'm actually going to try to finish up the book tonight. I think, maybe. Am I confident that I can do that? Well, I can't lie before the whole congregation. No, I'm not real sure I can do that. Any good Bible teacher worth his salt, well, they could do it, but I'm not so sure that I can, but I would certainly like to try. I think it's worth a try because you really can teach these three chapters pretty quickly and yet really well. So let's give it a shot and see how that goes. Chapter 19, verse 1. In those days, when there was no king in Israel, and again, just like chapter 18, chapter 19 gives us the first part of that statement in written form, and then does not give us the second half of that statement, but instead shows us the unwritten second part of that statement through history. So in those days, when there was no king in Israel, a certain Levite was sojourning in the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, who took to himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. Now, should a Levite have a concubine? Certainly not. In fact, no one should, because a concubine was essentially an additional wife that you married for the purpose of either procreational sex or recreational sex or both. So this is not behavior that the Lord would want from any of his people. Especially someone that was a minister of God, like a Levite. A Levite would be fine to have a wife, for sure. This isn't the Catholic Church. A priest and a Levite, they could marry, absolutely. But God did not want them having multiple wives. Certainly, he didn't want them having wives just for the purpose of sex. This Levite is doing what is right in his own eyes. I don't know. Maybe he looked at it like, well, hey, I'm a Levite, the tabernacle worker. I am working for the Lord. I mean, doesn't the Lord want me to be happy? Well, this is what would make me happy. Another wife. I would like to have some options, you know. This is what I think is good for me. So he did what he did. Much like people today who will say, well, what's wrong with being with someone that you love? Shouldn't you be happy? How can love ever be wrong? Well, love can be wrong if you're married and they're not married to you, or they're married and not married to you, or you're same-sex partners, or this is sex outside of a monogamous married relationship between a male and a female, then yes, it certainly could be wrong, even if it's quote-unquote love. So the Lord says those kind of acts, they're going to be harmful to you and to them. You might think you're doing the right thing for yourself, but the Lord says, no, I know better. You're not doing the right thing for yourself. You're harming yourself in some way, physically, emotionally, in some way. You're harming yourself. So we're better off to just obey God and then discover along the way the wisdom of God that comes from the blessings of just living a godly life, as the Lord tells us to. Verse 2, and his concubine was unfaithful to him, and she went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah, and was there some 4 months. Verse 3, then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and bring her back. He figures, you know, it's been 4 months. I kind of miss her. Maybe I should. And you know, he's a guy, so maybe he didn't notice she was gone until like 3 months. I don't know. But yeah, it's been 4 months. You know what? I think I should go try to win her heart back. It says he had with him his servant and a couple of donkeys. And she brought him into her father's house. And when the girl's father saw him, he came with joy to meet him. It would seem throughout this story that the father-in-law is actually wanting these two to get back together. Verse 4, and his father-in-law, the girl's father, made him stay, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and spent the night there. 3 times they did that. 3 days. Verse 5, and on the 4th day they arose early in the morning. This means the whole family was up early. And look at this. He, you could underline that, he prepared to go. I take that to mean just the Levite without his concubine. It would seem to me at this point in the story they have not reconciled. But it says, the girl's father said to his son-in-law, strengthen your heart with a morsel of bread, and after that, you may go. This is a stall tactic. He's trying to get the guy to stick around a little bit longer. He figures if the Levite sticks around, then that's going to give more time for these two to hash things out and fix things up. So he says, hey, before you go, man, grab a bite. Have some food. You're going to need that for the journey anyway. You're going to need to be well nourished for your travel. Have a meal first. Sure, then you can go, no problem. Verse 6, so the two of them sat and ate and drank together. And the girl's father said to the man, be pleased to spend the night. In other words, well, we took way too long to eat. Didn't think that meal was going to take that long. I didn't know it was going to take 3 hours for the bread to get done. Sorry about that. But it's too late now for you to be traveling, so you might as well just spend another night. You can leave in the morning. I promise. You can leave in the morning. I'll let you go. And he says, and let your heart be merry. Relax. Have some wine. Enjoy the evening. Verse 7. And when the man rose up to go, his father-in-law pressed him till he spent the night there again. Verse 8. And on the 5th day, he, again, just he, arose early in the morning to depart. Still no concubine as I read this. It's just him and his servant, of course, which is mentioned there earlier. It says, and the girl's father said, strengthen your heart and wait until the day declines. So they ate, both of them. Commas are important. So they ate, comma, both of them. Verse 9. And when the man and his concubine and his servant rose up to depart. So you see the difference there? Now it's not just the guy that's rising up to leave, it's him and his concubine. It would seem that the father-in-law's plan worked and that these two are definitely reconciled at this point and planning to travel home together. As his servant rose up to depart, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, "Behold, now the day has waned toward evening. Please spend the night. Behold, the day draws to its close. Lodge here and let your heart be merry." Please, just one more night of drinking. Just have one more night of drinking with me. "And tomorrow you shall rise early in the morning for your journey and go home." Now, I do personally believe this is a legitimate concern, as you're going to see shortly. I think he really means at this time that it's just too late in the day to travel at this point. If he did have ulterior motives, it would probably be something like, "Well, this has been fun. I have really enjoyed getting to know my daughter's husband. We spent a lot of time in the man cave together." Notice just those two hanging out in the man cave, eating, drinking, being merry. This is going well. He's got a buddy now, and maybe he doesn't want to lose, you know, that buddy. That could be an ulterior motive, but I do think he really means this, and sure enough, he's going to end up being right. It's just too late in the day for him to travel. Verse 10, "But the man," the Levite, "would not spend the night. He rose up and departed and arrived opposite Jebus," that is Jerusalem. "He had with him a couple of saddled donkeys and his concubine with him." Again, his servant is with him as well. He was mentioned earlier. Verse 11, "When they were near Jebus, the day was nearly over, and the servant said to his master, 'Come now, let us turn aside to the city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it.'" See, father-in-law was right. They didn't make the journey. It's getting dark. They're not home yet. They've got further to go, but now they're going to have to overnight. They need a place to stay. And the servant suggests, a very logical suggestion, "Let's just go to the first place we come to. We're right by modern-day Jerusalem. Let's just go there." Verse 12, "And his master said to him, 'We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners.'" Jerusalem was inhabited by Jebusites at this time. We just read it. Jerusalem would not be possessed and inhabited by the Jews until the reign of King David. So currently this is heathen town in Jerusalem. Verse 13, "And he said to his young man, 'Come.'" Oh, I skipped some, didn't I? "We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who do not belong to the people of Israel, but we will pass on to Gibeah. There be Jews in them thar parts." Those are our people. Those are family. So that should be safer. Should be safer. Famous last words. It's not going to be safer, but it seems like it should be. Verse 13. "And he said to his young man, 'Come and let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night at Gibeah or at Ramah," a Jewish town. Verse 14, "So they passed on and went their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin." Verse 15, "And they turned aside there to go in and spend the night at Gibeah. And he went in and sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night." Now, there were no Days Inns in those days. There were no hotels or motels. Strangers in town with no connections, no family, no friends. They were completely dependent on the hospitality of the people, and that usually worked just fine. It was even in the law of Moses as a requirement that the Jews would have to be hospitable to other Jews and even pagans. That was in their law. And it was pretty common for you, if you were passing through and you had no connections in that town, what you'd do is you go to the city square close to evening time and you just wait for someone to take the bait. You just wait for someone to come up to you and be hospitable and say, "Hey, come stay with me for the night. I'll give you food. I'll give you lodging." That was considered a very honorable thing to be able to do to a stranger for a Jewish person. So it usually worked quite fine. Not so much in this place, not Jerusalem, pardon me, Gibeah. Verse 16, "And behold, an old man was coming from his work in the field at evening. This man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was sojourning in Gibeah." So this guy was from Ephraim, but he is currently living and working in Gibeah. "The men of the place were Benjaminites," verse 17, "and he lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler," the Levite, in the open square of the city. And the old man said, "Where are you going, and where do you come from?" Verse 18. And he said to him, "We are passing from Bethlehem in Judea to the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, from which I come." So they share that in common. They are both from Ephraim. And he goes on to say, "I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and I am going to the house of the Lord," perhaps to work a shift in the tabernacle. That was his job. That was, at least by lineage, that was his job. I can't say for certain that he did that for a living, but by lineage, he should have been working in the tabernacle there in, normally Shiloh, further on in the history, but Bethel at this time, as we're going to see. And, you know, that was the priests and the Levites were scattered out throughout the whole land of Israel. And they would work in shifts. They would come down into Bethel now or Shiloh later, and they would spend some time there in that area, and they would work the tabernacle for their shift, for their course. And then once they were done, you know, a couple weeks on, whatever, then they go back to where they live. So that's probably what's happening here. He's planning to go back and work there in the tabernacle. But he says, "No one has taken me into his house." Verse 19, "We have straw and feed for our donkeys, with bread and wine for me, and your female servant and the young man with your servants. There is no lack of anything." He's saying, hey, no worries. No one's let us in their house, but we're just fine. We have enough provisions. Don't worry about us at all. And I know the wording is strange here, so just to help with some clarification, this is, all of this statement here in verse 19, this is the Levite talking to this old man from Ephraim, and he calls himself, his concubine, and his young male servant, your servants. That's what he says to this guy. And I just want to clarify that so you're not confused. What he's doing is just really a cultural way of expressing humility. He's calling them this man's servant. It's kind of like introducing yourself and saying, "Hi, I'm Arlen, at your service. I'm your servant, whatever you need." That was a cultural way to do that. It was the cultural way to say, I'm putting you above myself and above my family. Verse 20, "And the old man said, 'Peace be to you, shalom. I will care for all your wants. Only do not spend the night in the square. You do not want to be here after the sun goes down. When the sun goes down, this city square turns into Sin City.'" Verse 21, "So he brought him into his house and gave the donkeys feed, and they washed their feet and ate and drank." Verse 22, "As they were making their hearts merry, behold, the men of the city, worthless fellows, or ungodly men, or quite literally, sons of Belial," interpreted, that's sons of the devil, "worthless fellows surrounded the house, beating on the door. And they said to the old man, the master of the house, 'Bring out the man who came into your house, that we may know him.'" And they were not talking about getting to know him through conversation. Did I mention this message is not PG? You're all old enough here. I think you're going to be just fine. Yeah, he's talking about, they are talking about getting to know this man, this Levite, sexually. They want to have homosexual relations with him. Now, mind you, this is a Jewish town. So these are Jewish men wanting to sexually exploit this other Jewish man. So this is a horribly grotesque event in the history of Israel. And pervasive homosexuality is always one of the lower rungs on the ladder downward into depravity. That's just the truth. I don't care if that is culturally appropriate to say, or I don't care if it's culturally insensitive to say. It's the truth, and that's why I say it. I'm most concerned about biblical truth, what the Lord thinks, what the Lord feels, and that's what I want to stick with myself. That when things get this far in a society, there is usually no recovery from it. I was stretching my brain on that this week, trying to think, was there ever any culture that that became, you know, very pervasive in their homosexuality that actually survived, that actually lasted, reverted and came out of that. I can't think of one. Maybe you can. You can let me know later. But I can't think of one, honestly. When people can think that something abominable like that is acceptable, then they can think that just about anything is acceptable. Now, you have probably noticed that this story sounds strikingly similar to another story that you're familiar with. And that would be the story of Lot and Sodom taken out of Genesis chapter 19. I mean, it's incredible how closely these two stories correlate. I mean, they're almost identical, very close in many ways. There are differences, though. And you can read Genesis chapter 19 later and compare these two stories. Pretty remarkable. But I want to ask you, with these two stories being this similar, does that make this fishy? Like, is this maybe just like someone copied and pasted that story, put it here, changed some details to make it a little bit different? Did that happen? No, because they did not have copy and paste back then. But also, this is a different story, and even though it really is a near repeat of history, it is a separate story that happened during the lives of Moses and Aaron's grandchildren. It just happens to be a near repeat of history. I'm not, like, at all surprised by this. And I would wager to bet that this was not the last time that a similar thing like this happened in the history of the world. Similar things go on quite regularly, unfortunately, if not in this country, in other countries. So, no, I'm not surprised by this. And the similarity of the two stories, it doesn't cause me any struggle in believing this story to be historically true. Verse 23, and the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, "No, my brothers." Would you call these guys brothers? I would not call these guys brothers. This guy calls them brothers. Oddly enough, Lot did the same thing to the people of Sodom. By the way, that's where we get our name, our word sodomy, right? Lot did the exact same thing. Both of those two guys were trying to be tolerant. They were trying to be accepting. They were trying to get along. But what they end up doing is becoming friends with people that they really shouldn't. He says, "No, my brothers, do not act so wickedly." Lot said that same thing, too. Both of those statements. Genesis chapter 19, verse 7, he's saying what you're wanting to do is really wicked. It's really wicked, really disgusting. What's wicked about this? Is it the homosexuality or is it the homosexual rape that's going to happen in this story? Yes, it's both. Both are wicked in the eyes of the Lord. The Lord calls homosexuality an abomination. That's wickedness, folks. And it's just all the more worse when this is not just homosexuality between two willing partners, but this is forced homosexuality. This is homosexual rape. Reading on, "Since this man has come into my house, do not do this vile thing." Verse 24, "Behold, here are my virgin daughter and his concubine," the Levite's concubine. "Let me bring them out now, violate them, and do with them what seems good to you. But against this man, do not do this outrageous thing." So once again, Genesis chapter 19, this time verse 8. This is where Lot makes a similar offer. He offers his two virgin daughters to the men outside the home that were pounding down the door for the two men, which weren't really men, that were visiting Lot. And he offers his two virgin daughters and he says, "Please leave the two guys alone that are visiting me. Take my two virgin daughters instead. Do whatever you want with them, but leave these two guys alone." And let me clear this up right away. There is not a single part of this story that we would seek to condone in any way. And it's kind of crazy because I've heard Bible critics use this verse and say, I would never serve a God who cares so little about women that he would have them offer these women to be brutally raped just to save the men. Now that shows an incredible amount of biblical ignorance. Like they didn't even read the story. They certainly didn't get the point of this story. This is happening for the complete opposite reason of what the critics might think. This is actually just an accurate historical biblical account to show us how bad things can get in any society when that society abandons the Lord and does whatever it is that they want to do. So the story does not mar God's holiness. It actually further establishes it. And it's a warning to us that our society, that every society desperately needs the Lord, or else it may eventually devolve into something that looks similar to this. And I mean, honestly, we're not too very far from that in many of our cities in this country of America, are we? Things very similar to this do happen in this country. But quickly, let me answer an important question. Why did Lot and this old man from Ephraim, in both cases, offer up women instead of men? Is it because God values men more than he does women? Is it because God cares about men more than he does women? No, God is not chauvinistic. It is not because of anything like that. It is simply that both Lot in Genesis 19 and this man from Ephraim, they both understood enough about God to know that inappropriate heterosexual relations were less of a crime in the eyes of God than were homosexual relations. They know that much about the Lord. They knew that homosexuality was an abomination to God. America used to know that. America does not know that any longer. And that's a bad omen for the future that is to come if there is not a change, if there is not a turning back to the ways of the Lord and to his holiness and to appropriateness. And honestly, I don't expect it to. I don't expect the country to turn. I don't expect things to go in a different direction at all. I expect the current sway to carry America straight into the tribulation period, but they'll be without us Christians, because we won't be there. Verse 25. But the men would not listen to him. They did not want the women. They wanted the men. So the man seized his concubine and made her go out to them. And they knew her and abused her. Look at this. All night. They knew her sexually and abused her all night until the morning. And as the dawn began to break, they let her go, or at least what was left of her at this point. Verse 26. And as the morning appeared, the woman came and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was, until it was light. Verse 27. And her master rose up in the morning, which means he was actually able to sleep that night. Isn't that really just something? This is a Levite. His quote-unquote wife is out there getting abused, as we're going to find out, to death. And this tabernacle ministry worker is in there snoozing away. No problem sleeping. Slept like a baby last night. All that noise at the door, very soothing. And when he opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, behold, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. 28. He said to her, "Get up, let us be going." Okay, honey, time to go home. Is this a messed up story or what? And she's been raped all night long, and all she gets from her husband is, "Okay, come on, quit loafing, get up, let's go home." But the scripture says there was no answer. She was unresponsive, and though it's not written, he does know at this point that she is dead. Then he put her on the donkey, and the man rose up and went away to his home, verse 29. And when he entered his house, he took a knife, and taking hold of his concubine, he divided her. Yes, that means what you think it means. He divided her limb by limb into 12 pieces and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. So pretty twisted, disturbing stuff. This should be triggering to us, and yet if I know how things go, I would guess that there's going to be more people that are triggered by the negative things that I've had to say about homosexuality tonight than this actual story where this woman is sexually abused all night to the point of death. But such are the times that we live in, and I'll deal with any heat that I have to face on that. The truth is the truth. This Levite cuts up his dead concubine into 12 pieces. Why 12 pieces? Because he's going to send one piece to every single tribe within the nation of Israel. And he's wanting to send a message, and he's wanting that message to become a wake-up call for the nation. The message is going to be this: look what we have become as a nation. Look at what's taking place within our people, God's holy people. We've got to do something about this. And his wake-up call is going to be, as you would expect, very impacting upon the rest of the nation. Verse 30, and all who saw it said, such a thing has never happened or been seen from the day that the people of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt until this day. Which probably means that there were some pretty wild stories about life in Egypt passed down from the first generation. I would guess that that first generation saw stuff in Egypt that would probably curl our toes. But from the time of the Exodus up until this point, this event that we just read, that was the worst thing to happen among the Jewish nation. This does not take into account the story of Lot and Sodom, because that happened in Sodom before the forming of the nation, before the journey toward the Promised Land, even before the Exodus itself. So that's not taken into consideration here. But from the time of the Exodus, if you're looking for the worst story in the history of the nation up until this point, this is it right here, this story. So he says, verse 30, consider it, take counsel, and speak. Let's think about this, let's talk about this, and let's figure out what to do. Chapter 20, verse 1, then all the people of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba, including the land of Gilead. And the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah, verse 2. And the chiefs of all the people of all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 men on foot that drew the sword, 400,000 soldiers, verse 3. Now the people of Benjamin heard that the people of Israel had gone up to Mizpah, and the people of Israel said, tell us, how did this evil happen, verse 4. And the Levite, the husband of the woman who was murdered, answered and said, I came to Gibeah that belongs to Benjamin, I and my concubine, to spend the night. 5. And the leaders of Gibeah rose against me and surrounded the house against me by night. They meant to kill me, and they violated my concubine, and she is dead. Now notice he doesn't mention that, well, hey, it was actually us that threw her out there. It was actually our idea in the first place. He doesn't mention that she was sacrificed to save his own neck. He doesn't mention that they let it happen all night long. He doesn't mention that he was able to sleep through it. So this is revisionist history, and in true human fashion, he does a really good job of covering up his own wrongdoing in this. Verse 6, so I took hold of my concubine and cut her into pieces, because why not? Seemed like the right thing to do. And sent her throughout all the country of the inheritance of Israel, for they, Gibeah, have committed abomination and outrage in Israel. Verse 7, behold, you people of Israel, all of you, give your advice and counsel here. 8, and all the people arose as one man, saying, none of us will go to his tent, and none of us will return to his house. No one is leaving until Gibeah pays. Verse 9, but now this is what we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot. So we're going to go to war with Gibeah, verse 10. And we will take 10 men of 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel. and 100 of 1,000, and 1,000 of 10,000 to bring provisions for the people. So that means 10% of the nation is going to be in support of these war efforts. They are expecting a long war, and therefore they are setting up a system of food and anything else that might be needed during this battle. That when they come, they may repay Gibeah of Benjamin for all the outrage they have committed in Israel. Verse 11, so all the men of Israel gathered against the city, Gibeah, united as one man. So that's good to see. This has actually brought the rest of the nation together here. They found their unity, and it's a good unity. It is a unity against wickedness. So the Levites' wake-up call has worked for the majority of the nation. Verse 12, and the tribes of Israel sent men throughout all the tribe of Benjamin, saying, what evil is this that has taken place among you? 13, now therefore give up the men, the worthless fellows, the sons of the devil in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and purge evil from Israel. And that is definitely the appropriate punishment under the law of Moses. People who commit abominations such as these, they were to be put to death according to Moses. Reading on. But the Benjaminites would not listen to the voice of their brothers, the people of Israel. All right, now quickly, Gibeah was a smaller clan within the major tribe of Benjamin. Benjamin was one of the sons of Jacob, therefore one of the 12 major tribes within the nation of Israel. And Benjamin here sides with the worthless fellows. And why did they side with the worthless fellows? Because the worthless fellows were from their tribe, their larger tribe, the tribe of Benjamin. They're close family. They're our people. We got to defend them. Now, family or not, how can you side with people that have done something like this? Well, I guess we could look around at America right now, and we could say, well, how are people taking the sides that they're taking in America right now? Who does Hollywood side with? Who does Nashville, the music recording industry, side with? How about most politicians? Who do they side with? How about social media? Who do most social media outlets side with? How about the media, the news media even, in general? Who do they side with? Well, they side with an oppressive government. They side with criminals. They side with sexual deviance. You know these things. I could go on and on. So we could ask the same question. How did this happen in Judges 19? Well, how is it happening in America? It always happens the same way. It happens when people drift from the Lord and they don't turn around in that drifting, and ultimately they reject the Lord and ultimately lose every single shred of their moral compass. That's how it happens. It's happening all around us in this country. You know that. Not just this country, but the world. Verse 14, then the people of Benjamin came together out of the cities of Gibeah to go out to battle against the people of Israel. And from here on forward, here's what's going to happen. When the scriptures say Israel, it's now at this point referring to the 11 tribes. And it is leaving the tribe of Benjamin out of that. So it's officially Benjamin versus Israel. All right. So when you read Israel, that's speaking about the 11 unified tribes, the 11 tribes that are unified against the wickedness of Gibeah that's being defended by the whole tribe of Benjamin. Verse 15, and the people of Benjamin mustered out of their cities on that day 26,000 men who drew the sword, but no matter how many men they mustered, they wouldn't be able to catch up. Because this is one tribe against 11 tribes. Muster all you want. You're not going to catch up. Besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who mustered 700 chosen men, verse 16, among all these were 700 chosen men, so special ops guys, who were left-handed, yes. Everyone could sling a stone at a hare and not miss. And that's just the Bible teaching us that left-handers are awesome. superior in every way to right-handers. I believe that's the doctrinal statement here. All of these guys. What's that? Yeah. Right. Hey, write that down. So, Gibeah's 700 most accurate marksmen. They were lefties. I love that. And boy, were they accurate. It says here that they could sling stones at a hair and never miss. I guess the question is, okay, well, from what distance are we talking about? If this is 20 paces, that's really something. If this is 20 millimeters, that's not as impressive. Even I can do that. Of course, I am a lefty. Okay. But, no, I think obviously this is just a Hebrew idiom. It is an expression, and it means that these guys were deadly accurate with their slings. Verse 17, and the men of Israel, apart from Benjamin, so the united 11 tribes, mustered 400,000 men who drew the sword. All these were men of war. So just an update here. That is 26,700 Benjaminites against 400,000 of the 11 unified tribes. So those defending wickedness here are in the vast majority. I mean the incredibly vast majority here. I think it's the other way around in America. At least it feels like it to me, that those defending wickedness, or I guess I said that. Did I say that wrong? Those defending wickedness were vastly outnumbered. Is that the way I said it? That's the way I meant it. Those defending wickedness were vastly outnumbered, and I think it's the other way today. I think those defending righteousness are vastly outnumbered. Doesn't it feel that way to you? I think probably because it is that way. Verse 18, the people of Israel arose and went up to Bethel and inquired of God. And here's where we start to see that this is actually where the tabernacle was located at this time. We're used to hearing about it being located in Shiloh, because for the bulk of this time period of the judges, it was located in Shiloh. But remember, we're just two generations after Moses and Aaron here. The text is telling us that at the time, the tabernacle was located in Bethel. And it says, who shall go up first for us? This is them inquiring of the Lord. Lord, who shall go up first for us to fight against the people of Benjamin? And the Lord said, Yehudah shall go up first. Judah, verse 19. Then the people of Israel rose in the morning and encamped against Gibeah, 20. And the men of Israel went out to fight against Benjamin, and the men of Israel drew up the battle line against them at Gibeah, verse 21. The people of Benjamin came out of Gibeah and destroyed on that day 22,000 men of the Israelites. Okay, that did not go as expected. They've got 400,000 soldiers. Benjamin's got a measly 22,700. How did the tribe of Benjamin win the day here and kill so many of them? Well, first of all, this was taking place in the land of Benjamin, so they knew the land and the other 11 tribes would not. Secondly, Benjamin has those 700 special op lefties that can hit a hare with a stone from a sling at 20 paces, I guess. But I think more important than all of that, there is a spiritual element to this. And it's really the spiritual element that is going to affect this outcome and the outcome of the next battle. And we'll get to that spiritual element in just a little bit. Verse 22, but the people, the men of Israel, took courage and again formed the battle line in the same place where they had formed it on the first day. 23, and the people of Israel went up and wept before the Lord until the evening. And they inquired of the Lord, shall we again draw near to fight against our brothers, the people of Benjamin? And the Lord said, go up against them. Verse 24. So the people of Israel came near against the people of Benjamin the second day. 25. And Benjamin went against them out of Gibeah the second day and destroyed 18,000 men of the people of Israel. All these were men who drew the sword. Okay, something is definitely up, right? This has happened twice now. This should not be happening. 11 tribes should not be having their rear ends handed to them by one tribe. This should not be happening. Verse 26, then all the people of Israel, the whole army, went up and came to Bethel and wept. They sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. Verse 27. And the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, for the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in Bethel in those days. Verse 28. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, ministered before it in those days. So there's our time stamp. Saying, shall we go out once more to battle against our brothers, the people of Benjamin, or shall we cease? And the Lord said, go up, for tomorrow I will give them into your hand. Now, let's sort through this because these are complicated and confusing verses. Because the people have inquired twice from the Lord, Lord, what should we do? And then the Lord told them what to do, and then they promptly went out and lost both battles, and a total of 40,000 soldiers to boot. So what gives here? Well, it really is in their third attempt at inquiring before the Lord that I think really the answers are given to us on what went wrong during the first two attempts. The third time is a charm, right? The first two times they inquired of the Lord with the assumption that all was well between them and the Lord. They just showed up and they prayed, and that was that. And I'm sure they were emboldened by the fact that they were taking the right stand. They were taking a stand against wickedness. Surely the Lord would want to bless that, right? They thought so. I would say, yeah, it seems pretty logical to me as well. But the third time when they inquired of the Lord, they approached the Lord very differently. Now you can see that there is actually repentance this time. You can see that the nation, all 11 tribes, are actually turning back to the Lord with their whole hearts. Now that is indicated by the fact that they were finally approaching God the way that the Old Testament law required. You don't just disappear into sin for, you know, a handful of decades, desert on the Lord completely, and then decide today I'm just going to show back up and ask the Lord some questions because I need some answers. You don't do that. The Old Testament sacrificial system was a prescribed way on how to approach the Lord in every one of these situations. After that first loss, they had tears the second time. Didn't matter. After that second loss, they had tears again. They wept again. But this time they also fasted. That's taking the emotions of the heart to the next level, isn't it? Anyone can cry about stuff. But when you're fasting about something, now we can see that you're really serious with the Lord. And then, you know, here's the kicker in all of this. They bring, as the scripture has told us, a burnt offering and a peace offering. Does anyone remember from our Leviticus studies, what is a burnt offering to symbolize before the Lord? Consecration, dedication. And it was one of the non-obligatory offerings. It was a volitional offering. You didn't have to do this. A burnt offering was for a person that wanted to say, Lord, I want to dedicate my life to you. I want to give it all to you. I want to be yours. And then once you gave the burnt offering, well, then the sin offerings and everything else that followed were mandatory, right? Those were required. You needed sin covered. What was the peace offering to symbolize, according to Leviticus? The desire to fellowship with God. So you see how much better this third approach is? And do you see how much better the results were after this approach? They asked the Lord this time, Lord, do you want us to do this or not? Should we just stop this? And the Lord says, no, I want you to do this, and it's going to be different this time. Because now that I've got your heart, now that I've got your dedication, now that I've got your desire to fellowship with me, now I can fight for you. And now I can win this battle for you. Like today, that's what the Lord says. See, that was part of the agreement with the nation of Israel, wasn't it? From the law of Moses. God said, if you're going to be my people, then I'll be your God and I'll fight your battles for you. That was the problem. These 11 tribes, they really weren't God's people at the time. God couldn't fight for them. Now, the Lord was not lying to them the first two times in order to try to trick them into defeat. That's not what was happening. It's just that as wicked as the Gibeonites might have been, there was some hypocrisy in this for the other 11 tribes as well. They weren't talking with the Lord either. They weren't walking with the Lord either. So the Lord could not fight for them. He could direct them, which is what he did. He gave them the right answers, but he could not fight for them as their God until they were truly his people in their hearts. So yes, the Lord was giving them the correct counsel, the correct instruction. It's just that they were fighting on their own those first two times. That's what happened. That's what went wrong. They were fighting on their own. Now, I personally believe that had they continued that battle against Gibeah and against the Benjaminites, that they would have won. I believe that. I believe the Lord telling them, yes, go fight. I believe that was the Lord's way of saying, I want to judge these people for the wickedness that they've done and for defending wickedness from the tribe of Benjamin at large. That's what I want to do. So you go do that. You go make war against Gibeah. And if Benjamin's going to defend Gibeah, then, yep, you make war with Benjamin. And I believe they would have eventually won, but at a very high cost. At the loss of many soldiers because they were doing this on their own. That's why the third time was a charm. Because now they're not doing it on their own. The Lord is going to fight for them here. I hope that makes sense. If not, just pull this teaching back up later. Listen to it as many times as it takes for all of that to make sense. All right, so let me give you a quick lesson here. And then I think we're probably going to have to stop right here. I know. Surprised too that we're not going to get through it, but quick lesson to close out on. Here it is. Hypocrites should not go to war against wickedness. Hypocrites should not go to war against wickedness. You know what they should do? They should resolve their hypocrisy first. I'm talking to you and I'm talking to me. I know there's hypocrisy in you and I know there's hypocrisy in me. And this is the way that it is to be. The Apostle Paul tells us in Romans chapter 2, verse 1, that it is inexcusable for someone to judge someone else in something they themselves are doing. That's hypocrisy. Paul says it's inexcusable. Jesus taught us that you cannot try to remove the speck from someone else's eye when you got a beam in your own eye. And you know, the way that goes is that's actually the same material in both of your eyes. The speck, that's sawdust. Or a little tiny fleck of a twig, that's what that is. It's wood. What is a beam? That's wood. The only difference is not the thing, according to what Jesus was speaking about. It's just the volume of the thing. You know, you're bashing someone for some sin that they're committing, and yet you've got that same sin. Romans chapter 2, verse 1, or the words of Jesus, Matthew chapter 7. You've got that same sin, only worse. So we got to be careful with that, don't we? Every battle should start with this. Lord, cleanse me. My flesh is sinful by nature. I try to fight that. I try to resist that, Lord, but I'm not even going to try to pretend that I'm perfect. I know I fail you. I know there's hypocrisy in me. Lord, cleanse me, forgive me, and then, Lord, we can move forward. Once I have that confidence, isn't that what the Bible talks about? If you know you're not sinning against the Lord, if you know things are well with you and the Lord, that gives you the confidence that you need to build your faith and to live this life in the Christian faith.